This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. From the Mother Earth News Fair, we hear about life on the farmstead. Lisa Kivirist about turning your dreams of small-scale food into a real living. She does it in Wisconsin and has tips for us all. Then we go solar with author and speaker Dan Chiras, plus solar electrician Brad Burkhartsmeyer. I ask the questions you might like to know. Let's meet Lisa Kivirist. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. I'm here with Lisa Kivirist at the Mother Earth News Fair. And we've got lots to talk about, whether it's how you're going to make a living if you've got that dream of going back to the land, or how women are going to take a greater role in producing food. And if we have time, we might even find out how to eat and cook cheaper using organic food. That's right, maybe organic doesn't have to cost more. So we've got a lot to cover. I'd like to welcome Lisa to Radio EcoShock. Hi.
Thank you. Hi.
Why don't we begin? If you would tell me a little bit about yourself and about your operation in Wisconsin.
Sure. Happy to be out in Washington State, but home for my family and I is in South Central Wisconsin. We run a small farm and bed and breakfast in Serendipity out there. We're on 5 acres, completely powered by the wind and the sun, and are real diversified, as I'm sure we'll talk about. We wear a lot of different hats. We run the farm. We do diversified produce. We make muffins in the morning for the bed and breakfast to raise our family, and also do a lot of writing and outreach work on sustainability. And I particularly work a lot with women farmers and beginning farmers wanting to start operations.
Well, there's so much there we could work with. One of the things that I found was that when I went back to the country, I had a bright idea. I was going to grow all my own food and all that sort of thing. But I still needed money for some reason. And to do that, I needed to have some sort of a job. And you've written a book that has, as part of its title, Ecopreneuring. Why don't you tell us about the title of that book and some ideas about what people should think about if they're going to move back to the land and how they're going to make a living?
You bet. I gave you the short summary of what we do today, but the longer story is my husband John and I met when we were in our 20s working at what my mother still calls normal jobs in Chicago. We had the corporate cubicle gig and the paycheck every 2 weeks, and everything on the surface was what was expected of two college graduates. But we learned early on, it just wasn't what we said we valued. It wasn't what was getting us up in the morning. And we found ourselves escaping more and more on weekends, as many Chicagoans do, crossing the border north to Wisconsin, and typical hiking, biking, outdoor camping kind of stuff. And even though neither of us had rural roots, at least in one or two generations behind us, we were both suburban raised, we fell in love with the countryside and the rural areas and the cows in Wisconsin and the rolling green hills, and started thinking in our mid-20s, can we reverse this equation? Instead of living and working in the city and earning an income so we could escape and do what we wanted to on the weekends, could we live and work and earn our living here in the country and go back to the city when we wanted good Indian food or anything like that? So that's what started our journey that's been 17 years now. And our goal has been from the start to earn all of our income on farm. So we didn't want to commute to a job anymore. We didn't want W-2s. We didn't want to put on the suit and the heels or whatever else we didn't want to do. We wanted to generate that from home. So that involved two important things, which we write about in Ecopreneuring, is first off, to really cut back our expenses. There's real freedom in the less you need to live on, the more freedom we have to do what we want to do. And that happened slowly, because when we moved to the farm, as I mentioned, we had no ag background. We killed our zucchini the first year, if you could imagine. I don't think that's humanly possible. But we learned. And so over the years, we've learned how to go from not being able to raise zucchini to raising about 70% of our own food needs. And from being quite an inefficient farmstead when we started, to overproducing and getting a check back from the utility. So all of these things happen over time and still happen, but basically cut back what we need to live on so that there's more freedom in doing what we want to do. And then the second part of that, again, in Ecopreneuring, is how to have these multiple income sources and do it smartly so that you can be home-based. And that has to do with running it all under one business, taking advantage in many ways, and this is, we dial into more of the specifics in the book, of how to take advantage of at least our system here in America, where it supports small business. How can we do things, but from a green perspective, so that, yes, we can still earn a livelihood, but do it in a way that we feel values future generations, and also is something that we feel passionate about and gets us up in the morning. And for us, a big part of that is the creativity and diversification. We like to write. We like to grow vegetables. We like to host people around our kitchen table. It's very much a seasonal approach to living. So right now, in the beginning of June, it's that crazy busy time, both on the farm with the B&B, etc. And in the winter, things slow down outside, and that's when we do more of our writing and get more of the keyboard clicking income. So it varies, but it balances, and it's lean, importantly. So that's what enabled us from the get-go to, again, stay on farm with what we wanted to do.
I love that story. And I know that the summertime is when it's just one big buzz trying to get everything done.
It's great.
Before it gets cold again.
You bet.
You got to have your wood in the shed, too, if you're heating with wood.
You know exactly. And it's funny you say that, because we just finished, before we came out here, doing our wood cutting for the year. Because we've learned the hard way, if we don't get it done before June, it gets hot and buggy, and that's the worst time to be cutting wood. So, yep, we are ready to go come next fall.
Yeah. Well, you wanted to give it a chance to dry, too.
Exactly.
Would you give us the title of that book for people who want to follow up?
Sure. Ecopreneuring. It's a combo word we came up with of ecology and entrepreneurship, but basically putting that sustainability element in small business. And we got a nice compliment the other day from somebody who said, you know, this book has everything I did not learn in business school, because it has to do with, again, taking it, using the structure we currently have legally, I might add, but doing it with those sustainability principles in mind. For example, travel mileage. So we drive into town, for example, and we need to pick up some eggs from another farmer, let's say, for our bed and breakfast. Those are business miles. The IRS determines what's a business mileage rate based on the whole car fleet, right? You know, Hummers and all. And it was 55 cents last year. I know it's increasing this year. But that's a business expense. So we have a notebook in our glove compartment of our Jetta. We have a diesel Jetta that runs really efficiently. It doesn't cost us 55 cents a mile to run that car. But sure, we track those miles. Those 10 miles into town and 10 miles back add up. And that's a business expense. So it basically reduces our taxable income, which, again, adds to that bottom line in ways. So it's constantly thinking about things of how they can become part of your business expense. And so you can do things in a way that both express your values, and in our case, are things we're passionate about, but that add up to a sustainable livelihood. We can talk about sustainability all we want, you know, but to your point earlier, if we can't make it work from a livelihood perspective, it's just a hobby. And it needs to be more than that, I think, for people to really embrace change.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith and Linda Kivarist. Now, the other thing that we started out talking about a little bit was women taking part in the growing of food and food production. Now, we're not talking about being in the kitchen necessarily, although it's great to be there, and I'm trying to encourage more men to be in the kitchen. But let's talk about women getting out onto the farm. What are you doing there?
Yeah, it's really exciting. Now, to your point, women, the connection between women and food and growing food is not new. This has been going on since time began. However, specifically in the States, in the last agricultural census, this happens every 10 years, and through our USDA, we survey characteristics of farmers across the board. There was a close to 30% increase in the number of women-owned and operated farms, which is huge. It's the only group of farmers currently that's increasing, the second being Hispanic farmers. So it's still a statistically small but vibrant source of new farmers. And we all hear about just the decline of family farms and the growing age of family farms. This is a hot pocket to really change things. And what's interesting about this group of women, too, is for the most part, they're running really small, diversified, sustainable, locally focused operations. And interesting, too, is many of these farms are being started by women in their 40s, 50s, second careers. A lot of the women I know will meet here this weekend at the fair who are doing this very intentionally. You know, it's not just a job. I need a paycheck. I'm going to grow something. This is a calling of passion. I want to change how people eat in my community. I want to help support healthy kids. I want to get my hands in the soil, et cetera. So it's very exciting. Now, part of the reason you see this increase in the number of women-owned farms is, in a nutshell, historically, they haven't been tracked. It only started about 20 years ago when the USDA in the States started tracking gender of farm ownership. So historically, they've just always been in the male name, typically, you know, husband's name. So we're kind of playing catch-up, if you will, to accurately track the diversity of farms that is increasing today. So now when you fill out your ag census, it happened this last year, there's spots for four owners on a farm, four people who are principal operators and have a direct responsibility in the managerial role of the farm, because things are changing in a good way. You know, there's more family partnerships. There's more diversity in farms that needs to be reflected. So what I do is I work with, it's called the Midwest Organic Sustainable Education Service, MOSES, which is kind of the hub in the Midwest for organic information and runs the largest organic farming conference in the country every February. And I work with what's called the Rural Women's Project. So we do women farmer training and outreach to help support this group of women. Despite all these wonderful growing statistics, it's not like we have some 30% increase in farm bill funding or anything close to that. We won't go there. It's not reflected in policy, much less federal funding. We're working on that. We need to champion these voices. But on the flip side, we also need to provide support and networking and training for women going into farming. So we find that it's a very peer-supported group. There was actually specifically a study out of the University of Wisconsin a couple years ago now looking at women in Wisconsin, women farmers, but the same would be throughout the country, on where women farmers go to for information when they need their tractor repaired, et cetera. And this probably won't surprise folks really, but they found out statistically that hands down women go to other women. They go to other farmers for information. And a second resource is grassroots nonprofits like MOSES. And then as you get down the list, further down the list, you see more traditional sources of farm information, the FSA, the Farm Service Agency, or Extension. So it's women going to other women. So we try to build on that. There's a lot of knowledge that we all have and share. And so we do a number of workshops, and particularly on-farm workshops on women-owned farms, of this sharing of information to help particularly younger women, beginning women farmers, get operations started.
Right. I've interviewed a couple of people who are starting out different organizations working, trying to encourage young women to get farming and how to find the land and how to get going. So I think that is a whole new field of endeavor, if we can abuse that word. You also, though, you're giving a workshop on organic eating on a dime. I'd like to hear about that, because usually when I go to the store, the organics are over here. They're twice as much or more expensive than the stuff that's covered in pesticides, which I've never understood. They've got to pay extra for those pesticides. But anyway, how can we eat cheaper organically?
Yeah, no, that's my favorite question. And that's what we wrote our cookbook Farmstead Chef on, is recipes and ideas for us to get back in our kitchen, get out of the processed box food aisle, and do so in a frugal way. So the workshop I'm going to be giving here on the fair is exactly that, organic eating on a dime. And I joke about it when I start the presentation, because I'm like, you know, I wrote the description, but it's a little misleading in the sense of organic. Yes, it's a federally certified word right now here in the States, and there's a lot of good behind it, but it's not just only the word organic. You know, it has to do with local and seasonal. And it's June, and now's the time I want to be buying those local strawberries, not the organic shipped from halfway around the world in January. You know, so we have to always keep educating ourselves about labels, because there's so many new words and misused words around us now that it's not 100% organic is what we're going after here, for at least from my perspective. You know, I would much rather be supporting my local economies, knowing my farmer, knowing how they treat the land and what they do or do not do to it, than buying blindly from China. So that's part of it. And on a dime in the sense of cheap. Do you know, I always have this discussion with my mom. She's like, well, the difference between the word cheap and frugal. I'm like, I'm not cheap, Mom. I'm frugal. Do you know, I want to use the money I have in a way that I feel good about my purchases. Do you know, and as a society, we really undervalue food. I mean, we've gone statistically so low in the proportion of our household budget, 10% and under now, that is being used for food purchases. We're just so used to cheap food that we don't even bring it into question. And I think we need to re-examine that equation. So given all that, though, there still are strategies to doing so, and doing so in a way that can increase both our food and our health and decrease the amount we have to spend. One thing, for example, we do a lot that we learned quickly when we moved from the city to the farm is stocking up and keeping a pantry at all times of what are the key ingredients you need to buy and use so that you can cook more at home. Part of the increase in our food purchases and the amount of household budgets going towards food purchases is not increasing in the bulk food aisle. It's increasing in the takeout aisle. You know, it's increasing in the fast food lane. It's because we're busy as a society. That could be a whole other show, do you know, but it's the reality. And part of that is not having, at least I feel, not having both the supplies, the ingredients, and the knowledge at home to cook. And that's what we talk about in Farmstead Chef. I'm convinced, you know, food and cooking, it's not this time drain. It takes time to go out and earn the income. It takes time to go out through the fast food aisle, and it takes time to sit and eat there. Do you know, it's always time. It's just how we spend it. And how can we change that equation? So yeah, we have our staples. We have our flours and our sugars and our grains at home, in addition to our fresh produce, our preserved produce, ideally from our own garden. But if we can't do that, there's such a wonderful abundance now of purchasing local and seasonal, be it from farmers markets or belonging to a community-supported agriculture, a CSA, et cetera, so that we can get some more of those strategies in our own home to have the key ingredients to be able to cook more at home.
And the food's cheaper when you buy it in bulk, that's for sure. We started making our own granola just recently because I was reading the label, and really the manufacturers, and it is a food manufacturing industry, most of the cost of food now is in the manufacturing. It's not the actual food stuff that you and I have just been talking about. And they know what we want. We want salt, we want sugar, and we want fat. And they put all of that in there. And when we make our own, we don't have to do that, and we're going to live longer without the diabetes and all the other problems that are so prevalent now in American society. What are your thoughts on that?
No, you nailed it out totally. Food's a big business, and our policies reflect that, and we need to break that chain. And to your point, understand labels, understand ingredients, understand the dollars that go into making that, the advertising, the marketing, the packaging. There's so many layers to it. And to break out of that, we found personally in our own family very empowering, you know, to be like, we don't need that. We don't need to rely on somebody else to both tell us what we need to eat and supply it. You know, we can do that. And it's a totally an ongoing journey. We mentioned I've been on the farm now 17 years, but every garden is a new chapter, you know, I mean, both good and bad in the sense of understanding and dealing with climate change. Last year was a huge drought by us, and some things did better than others. And this year we just had our first kale crop right before we left to come here, and it was just amazing and wonderful and the best we've ever had. So Mother Nature, I think, really adds a element to eating seasonally that we've lost, you know, in the sense of we're so used to getting everything we want 24/7 as food that we've lost that flavor element. We've lost the anticipation element. I'm dying to get back home because probably by the time we get back home, we'll have the first strawberries, you know, and we'll gorge for the next couple weeks and eat all we can fresh. And when we get tired, we'll start freezing and canning and then wait until next June to do that again. But we don't do that anymore as a society. You know, it's like Christmas all the time. We can have whatever we want all the time, and we can buy it all the time. And in our own family, and this is what we try to do a lot in our writing and the workshop here, is how can we look at that more objectively and start making changes to get back to, in many cases, the way our grandparents used to eat? And we'll find not only our health improving, but more money at the end of the day, too.
Well, we can joke around about it, but one of my theories is we should eat like a bear. You know, on our land, the bears would show up when the mushrooms were ready, and they'd come back when the wild apple trees were doing their best. So you do eat things in season, and yes, we should preserve things, and I do that. But I'm going to ask you, as we sort of wrap up, in Wisconsin, what are you doing for your food in the wintertime?
No, that's a great question. And it's interesting because wherever you live, we all have challenges of climates. We were in Florida a little bit this past winter, and you kind of think a place like that, they must just eat out of their backyard all the day. And I was sad, actually, in the lack of local agriculture there. It's not, you know, in many cases, it's embedded coral. You can't grow in parts of Florida. Everybody has their challenges. In Wisconsin, we have a shorter growing season than other places, but we also have, in general, some good weather support. You know, I mean, besides the drought last year, we were making up for it in rain this year. So what we do is basically, you know, around the May through October season, we eat as much fresh as we can out of the garden. And then we preserve a lot. And there's a lot of different strategies for that. And a lot of different specific great advice will be here at the fair. We do a little bit of everything. We primarily freeze. We have a large chest freezer in our basement. And as I mentioned, we run the farm on wind and sun, so we're all electric. So that works economically in our household picture. And part of the reason we freeze a lot is time in the summer. You know, we're busy. So I can blanch some greens and freeze them a whole lot faster than I can can tomato sauce and do other canning and dehydrating things. So that's what we do. We do it to the point of extremes. Even when talking about tomatoes, I'll often freeze clean and core and freeze whole tomatoes and stick them in the freezer. And then come January, when I have time and want something hot simmering on the wood stove, I'll defrost those slowly in the refrigerator and then make sauce out of them. So we keep a pretty seasonal diet year round there. Eating different things at different times of the year, and some years having an abundance of one thing versus the other. But it always gets us thinking creatively, too. One tip I talk about in the Organic Eating on a Dime workshop is that we do in our family is every year after the Christmas, December holidays in January, we will literally go cold turkey with buying food, like just about anything, because it forces us to eat what we have at home. It sounds really simple, but when we talk about eating seasonal, do you know those frozen zucchini I have in the freezer? That's not red wine. It doesn't get better year to year. Part of the thing about eating seasonal is to, yes, preserve from the garden, but then eat it over the course of the winter and start fresh. But we have this cold turkey plan because we need a little bit of motivation. Do you know those greens in the freezer don't look that interesting in February, do you know? And you start seeing things in the grocery store and you're like, yeah, that looks great. That's fresh. And we need some new challenges. So by not buying anything, it gets us creative with recipes. We come up with some new things, some new ways to eat those greens. A recipe we have in the Farmstead Chef Cookbook that we discovered during one of these leaner winter times of seasonal eating is a spanakopita, a traditional spinach Greek pie with the feta cheese and phyllo. You sometimes see it at Greek restaurants, but that's a great way to use the frozen greens, and the feta cheese really livens it up. And of course, I'm from Wisconsin, so I got to get good cheese plugs in. But so it's things like that that we start thinking about. And then come March, April, we'll literally unplug the freezer. Our pantries will be cleaner too, in the sense of there'll be some space. It helps going into the new spring season. And it gets us using what we have. And it's a huge way to save money. For example, even in our pantry, we all seem to accumulate different things. Do you know, I'm always so excited when I go to the food co-op and I see the bulk aisle with all these funky grains and quinoas and things that I didn't grow up eating, do you know? So I don't know how to cook them, but I get so excited when I see them and I buy them and they sit in my pantry until March, when I'm forced to figure out how to do this. And I learned about amaranth and barley and all these new things this past season. And even those things don't last forever. You know, you want to use them eventually. And then come the late spring, we have some space in our pantry, we have a clean freezer, and we do it all over again. So that's a big tip for us for saving money, is to basically use what we have.
I just love that idea, because I know so many of us end up, we've got great ideas, but then we end up throwing it out, frankly,
yeah,
instead of really trying to innovate and cook the way you're talking about. So, Lisa Kivarist, would you just tell us about the titles of your books? Tell us about your website and how people can follow up with you.
Sure, thank you. Yeah, we have three books. My husband, John Ivankoe, and I co-authored. One book actually we didn't talk about is our first book is Rural Renaissance, Renewing the Quest for the Good Life. That's our book, our story of moving from the Chicago urban scene to our farm in Wisconsin, and a lot of basic sustainable living starter resources, how to get started with organic gardening or renewable energy. It's honestly the book we wished we had when we moved but couldn't find, the book that was telling us we weren't crazy in what we were doing, and here's some resources to get started. So that's one. The second is Ecopreneuring, which stemmed out of Rural Renaissance, because we were getting feedback from folks like, hey, I really find your story interesting and inspiring, but tell me the specifics. How can you live? How can you create this livelihood on what the government actually defines as less than poverty level? It's not a lot, but it's sustainable, and it's very enriching for us. So that goes more into the business nuts and bolts. And our last book, Farmstead Chef, is a cookbook that goes into both the recipes and strategies and inspiring stories from different farmers and food activist friends of ours on how we can get back in the kitchen and eating more seasonal and local. And all the stuff you can find off of our main farm website, In Serendipity, InnSerendipity.com.
And the in part, I guess, is because you also have a B&B, so people can remember it that way, InnSerendipity.com. That's great. Thank you so much for talking with Radio EcoShop.
Thanks for all the good work you do. Thank you.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website, We're at ecoshock.org.
Radio EcoShock continues from the Mother Earth News Fair in Puyallup, Washington. Does it pay to go solar? Dan Chires worked alternative energy for 3 decades, writing 30 books in the process. Dan visited me in the Radio EcoShock mobile studio.
I want to see you in the sun.
We're here at the Mother Earth News Fair with Dan Chires. He's the director of the Evergreen Institute. He is an expert on sustainability. He's the author of numerous popular books and articles, and we're going to talk about some of those. We're going to be talking about solar electricity for you, whether we are entering a new energy revolution, maybe how you could heat your home if we get enough time with solar power. I'm interested in all of those things. I'm planning a little bit of a homestead for myself. Dan Chires, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, thank you. It's good to be here.
So you're giving several workshops, are you, at the fair?
I'm doing one workshop on heating your home with solar and another one on solar, you know, providing electricity through solar electricity. And then I'm doing the keynote. The sustainable energy revolution has begun.
All right. And how long have you been doing this?
Oh, I started in solar back in 1976. I put my very first solar system on my first home in 1977, and I've been doing it ever since then.
Well, I went back to land homesteading around 1979. We lived for 10 years without electricity. I looked into solar at the time and, wow, you know, like a 50-watt panel was huge and it was $3,000. I couldn't do it at the time. Now it's a lot different. How kind of expensive is it? Can people really do solar now?
Absolutely. The prices have just plummeted. We're, you know, back in the early 70s, the price was $75 a watt. Today, it's 75 cents a watt. It's come down that much. And it's gotten to the point where even without any tax credits, we can produce electricity from solar systems that's price parity with the local utilities in areas on the East Coast and the West Coast. In other words, you buy a solar system, install a solar system, and you calculate the 30-year cost of electricity from that system. It's the same as a lot of people are paying in the East Coast and the West Coast of the United States without any subsidies. And it's actually pretty close to the price we're paying in big cities throughout the country, maybe just a little bit more. Now you add that 30% federal tax credit and we're kicking butt. I mean, we're actually producing electricity 3 or 4 cents a kilowatt hour cheaper than you're paying, say, in Kansas City or St. Louis or certainly Chicago, any of the large cities. So, and not much more than you'd pay out in a rural area from a rural electric cooperative. So the price has plummeted, and we think it's only going to go down more. So it's a great buy. I mean, it's a terrific buy. And believe me, we've been waiting for a lot of years to be able to say that because it's always been, well, don't worry about the price. You know, we're doing this for the environment, which is great. You know, for some of us, it works really, really well. But for a lot of customers, they worry about the price. And so it's been a lot of years that we've been hoping to be able to say, hey, we're competitive, in many cases, cheaper than electricity from nuclear power plants and coal-fired power plants. And that's exciting news. I mean, that is really exciting news.
Well, that's the price of power now. And we know what's happening with nuclear power. Those plants are aging and they have no plan for their waste. Don't get me started on all that. And then we look at the price of oil. It's gone up. It's going to go even more. We're not making any more of it. And, you know, I just think that if you calculate it and it works on the prices now, you're going to be way ahead 10 years from now when the cost of electricity just goes up and up and up.
He's the author of 30 books, a medical grad sucked in by the alternative energy revolution. Radio EcoShock will be right back with solar expert Dan Chires from the Mother Earth News Fair. Here is Shane Phillips. See you in the sun.
I want to see you in the sun.